Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The Karen Reed case, it just got a bit of a curveball that left even the judge needing a timeout. One of the, I think, most shocking moments I've ever seen of a judge's reaction after getting information from the prosecution. The latest bombshell in this, the prosecution is coming out and accusing the defense of hiding key witness connections and potentially coaching an expert witness on their testimony, a move that had Judge Beverly Cano so concerned she abruptly halted the hearing mid-session. Now we're looking at the possibility of expert witnesses being tossed, legal ethics in question, and a defense team that could be playing damage control. But is it an issue? Is this just more courtroom chess? Was Beverly just having a bad day and reacting really strongly? Joining us to discuss is defense attorney and host of the podcast, Defense Diaries, Bob Mata. Bob, when you saw what we all saw the other day in court, and Beverly said that they're going to go in that recess and she needs some time, and used the terms grave concern, how bad is this for the defense of Karen Reed? What are we looking at?
At first blush, if you were the defense, you had to have been concerned. You know, I mean, she uses the term grave concerns and then, you know, then backs that up with profound impact,
you
know, on both the defense team and the defense itself, meaning, you know, the ARCA experts are in peril in relation to the defense that they're looking to put forth. And then you've got the problem with most likely Alan Jackson, because he's the easiest one for her to remove from the case if that was what she was inclined to do, because he's in on what they call a pro hoc vice license, which just means that you're temporarily licensed to practice in that state for that one case. Like, you apply, you have a sponsor. I'm sure Yannetti's his sponsor, you know, and it's the same thing they did with Robert Alisi, because he's a New York lawyer. It's what they're trying to do with Mark Bettereau, who's another New York lawyer who's trying to get on. So, I mean, you have to be concerned, you know, because the way that Brennan kind of did it, you know, he had filed his motion, which we all knew about, which was trying to bar either the ARCA witnesses, Rensselaer and Wolf, entirely from being able to testify at all, or at least limiting what they're able to get into based on what he's claiming is a Rule 14 discovery violation, meaning that they haven't been able to turn over what they are required to turn over under that rule. So, you know, when you're sitting there on its face, I think that Jackson and the team probably weren't thinking anything of it. You know, it's going to be an argument like, look, they got everything that we got. You know, it's like in terms of what the rule says, we'll send everything that we have, which they did, and that's kind of where this thing went off the rails with Brennan in terms of how he termed it at that time. I mean, if you look what preceded Judge Cannone saying, all right, I need a minute, you know, like suddenly, and then leaving the bench for 30 minutes, you know, it was prefaced by Hank Brennan saying, well, it wasn't the defense who turned over these emails to me that had all this information about a fee that may have been paid that had the script for the direct examination that had gone back and forth between Alan Jackson and Wolf. It was the feds that turned it over. So I think as soon as she heard that, it put up a red flag in her mind. She starts thinking about to all the hearings that had taken place prior to the trial and during the trial as to whether or not she was going to allow these witnesses to testify. They ended up having the, you know, the voir dire where they put the witnesses on and she's able to ask questions along with the attorneys to find out whether or not she's going to allow them as the gatekeeper of the evidence to come in and testify. So she's, that's all running through her mind. And, you know, and then he doubles up. So he, like, he says it that, you know, it wasn't the defense that sent this to me. It was the feds. And then he, like a sentence later, he's like, and I got this all through my TUI request, which a TUI request is when you have the feds involved and not, they're not a party to the case. You've got to send a request to them. If they have information that you're trying to use and you have to see if they're okay with you using it, and then they'll send you an answer. And that's how all of them received the documentation, the testing and the reports from what their investigation had shown when they retained ARCA, talking about the DOJ. So they all got the same thing. And that's a big deal, dude, because in Gull's, or oof, Freudian slip, in Canoni's mind, that is a situation where she's thinking the defense is trying to hide the ball. And if she's thinking the defense is trying to hide the ball, I mean, what's going to be the next question you're going to ask yourself if you're Canoni? Why are you trying to hide? What are you trying to hide from me? You know what I mean? So yeah, that set up that entire thing.
Are they trying to hide the ball, though? I guess that's the question. Could this be just an honest mistake of, you know, they're working the case, somebody, one of them, one of their assistants, somebody under them didn't file this piece, did not let the court know, did not let the prosecution know that we have now hired this group for almost $29,000 to be witnesses for us. Could this have just been, well, we thought it was in there. We thought we did that. Shit, we didn't. And we proceeded as if we did. Could that be an honest mistake? Or would there be too many things that would have been safeguarding that from being an honest mistake?
So here's the way that I look at it. And when you kind of try to put the pieces of the puzzle together as to what actually went down, if you'll recall, as soon as Brennan stood up after Judge Canoni came back on the bench, after she took her little break, visibly upset.
Yeah.
You know, like you could see her. She was breathing heavily. Her hand was shaking. She took her glasses off her. Like, you know, she was.
Yeah.
Whatever the case may be, whether it was outrage, whether it was she was
shaken. It was like someone reacting to a trauma. Like,
yeah,
it was like when I first saw it, I was with you. You showed me when we were talking about it. Like the first reaction is like, did somebody die in her life? Did she just get horrible news? Because it's like, oh my God, no, it's about the case. It was stunning.
And you're talking about a judge that's been up there for a long time and has seen it all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's what kind of really, I'm like, wow, like she's having a react. I mean, you know, judges deal with bullshit all the time.
Yeah.
You know, they deal with sniping attorneys. They deal with attorneys pointing fingers at one another. Like, none of that is going to be something that she's never experienced. So her reaction really, really kind of blew my hair back. I'm like, wow, like what is going on here? And, you know, but remember, the first thing that Brennan does is he corrects himself. And he says, yeah, Your Honor, I just, on the record, I want to correct the fact that this actually was sent to me by the defense. Mm-hmm. So that, like, immediately has to change something in her mind. Because it goes from, like, okay, they're trying to hide the ball, to, okay, they weren't trying to hide the ball. But now I've got to deal with the fact, did something untoward happen here? Mm-hmm. So, and what I think, and you've got a couple of issues. You've got the payment, or and let's be clear, Alan Jackson, after that hearing, when asked by the press outside in front of the courthouse, unequivocally stated, when asked, did you make a payment to ARCA? He said, absolutely not. Now, Alan Jackson, I don't give a shit what you think about that guy in terms of how you feel about the Karen Reed case, is a very, very accomplished lawyer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a prosecutor back in the day. He prosecuted, you know, the mogul, record mogul Phil Spector. You know, I mean, the guy has a storied career. Lawyers like that that have spent decades building their reputation and having an excellent reputation in the legal community are not going to blow up their practice, their reputation that they have like just carefully manicured for so many years over a case. Mm-hmm. So when Alan Jackson saying, absolutely not, we didn't send the money out, I believe that Alan Jackson and that in his office did not send the money out. I think that's going to come to bear on the 25th. I think that's a non-issue. I'll die on that hill. If I'm wrong, I'll eat crow. I'll be like, oh shit, Jackson's in deep shit. You know, so let's assume that that didn't get paid, because again, the way that Brennan worded that was he made it sound as if it got paid out.
Yeah.
But what it really was is it was an invoice sent by ARCA to the defense. But timing is everything, all right? Because what you had here is you had the situation where both parties get the discovery from the feds, right? And this is leading up to trial. I think it's in February of 2024. They all receive all of the reports and all this information from the feds. The defense is obviously looking at it and they're looking at the report like, holy shit, like they came down like on our side of this without them having hired that. Like that was the big point with those two witnesses. And I talked about it all the time. What made them amazing witnesses for the defense is the fact that they were independent, truly independent. They weren't retained by either party. So they were just coming in. They had done their own investigation. They had had no conversations with anybody prior to the investigation, which is going to be a key point.
Mm-hmm.
Like the defense will hammer that home, that that report and the investigation and the testing was all done prior to either side even knowing that they were doing it. So that report is what it is. It was not impacted by the defense. It was not impacted by the Commonwealth. It is what it is. It existed before either of them knew that it was in existence at all. So When you've got that report, it then becomes an issue, because you then have the situation where Yannetti's in court before the voir dires took place. Again, that's where they put the witnesses on the stand and where Judge Cannone's going to determine whether or not they're going to be able to testify. And ultimately she ruled that they were, obviously. But, you know, that's where you have Yannetti saying the only thing that once we got the report leading into it is we talked about their background and education. That was it. Like, we weren't talking about the substance of the report. After the voir dire happens, after the judge says, yes, I'll allow them to testify, at that point, this is going to be one of the X factors for us. When was the prep script created? Mm-hmm. There is nothing untoward or wrong with an attorney for either side prepping their witnesses and having discussions with their witnesses. I mean, defense counsel, if we've got a technical issue or a scientific issue, I'm not a DNA guy. I'm not a phone data forensic guy. That's not my field. So I hire experts for two reasons. One, to educate me. Two, to look at the reports from the other side and say, all right, where can we attack this? And, you know, also to go through and explain to me what things mean in their own reports. So when you're prepping your witness, you need to have those conversations. So assuming that we're going to get the date, because that was one of the problems, you had this concept that money had been requested. Hank Brennan was making it sound as if the defense had sent the money. The timing of when that happened, what it was for, was it for retaining them or was it for cost? Again, you can't expect experts, if the feds are like, whatever, you can use these guys, you're not doing it on our dime. You're going to have to pay for their travel. You're going to have to pay for their housing. You're going to have to pay for their food, you know? And so like, it depends on what the money was used for. And more importantly, when it was paid, if it was paid.
Yeah. And that's the question. I mean, I totally get it. When you have your own expert witnesses that you're bringing on, you're paying for your expert witnesses. The problem here lies, isn't it, the fact that this wasn't their expert witness, or it wasn't defined to the court and defined to the prosecution that now these guys are our expert witness now that we're done with the mutual sharing of their study?
I don't think so, because that's what I'm saying. Timing is everything, T. If you've got a situation where if we find out on the 25th that the script for the direct examination that Jackson was putting together, that he was sharing back and forth with Dr. Wolf, if that is dated after Judge Cannone has said, I'm allowing you to call them, I don't see any issue whatsoever, because they have now been told, yes, you can testify. They have no reason that they have to go in blind putting that witness on. They'll be able to prep their witness because they're now calling him. Still an independent witness, not retained by the defense, but you're calling that person, and you need to be able to discuss with them, all right, this is how the direct examination is going to go. You know, do you have any thoughts? And, you know, then he's looking at it and he say, oh, you know, maybe ask this. So,
but did it go beyond just prepping a witness, though? I mean, especially if this is an independent witness and it's not, I mean, obviously, like, an expert witness is supposed to be sharing the truth to begin with, but, you know, that can work sometimes. If this is, you know, this was an independent, they're going to take him over here and they're going to use them as their own. They're going to pay them so they become basically their witness. Doesn't that part need to be disclosed, that it went from neutral territory with this initial study that's here you go to everybody to now we're going to go over here, we're going to prep you, they literally went back and forth, I can omit that, or I don't have to say that if you don't want me to. Things like that, that just seems like, okay, that's fine if you had said to the court, we're going to use them. We're going to take them, we're going to pay them.
That's what I'm saying, they did. Yeah. Like that's what I'm saying. Like what's going to happen on the 25th. So there was the money part. That's one of the issues as I see it. The other part is going to be exactly what you're talking about. That conversation where the direct examination script, which every lawyer does it. Like
witnesses,
you're going to put those together. We're going to get the date that was generated. And assuming that date is after Judge Cannone said, yes, I'm going to allow them to testify for the defense. The Commonwealth knew. I mean, once they, like, that was what caused the voir dire. Mm-hmm. So Lally was like, oh, well, I want to keep them out. Judge Cannone said, all right, well, we're going to call the witnesses in. And it was Russell and the two doctors, Wolf and Rensler. We'll bring them all in. We're going to conduct a voir dire and I'll decide whether or not I'm going to let them testify. So I'm assuming, and again, if I'm wrong, then Jackson's going to have some problems.
Yeah.
If I'm right, I don't think he's going to have any problems, because once the judge says I'm allowing them to be a defense witness, they're a defense witness. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, like, at that point,
sure,
Commonwealth knows, the judge knows, everybody knows that they're defense witnesses. So him prepping his witness leading up to trial is not an issue for me. And you know, when you're thinking about it, like, is it a bridge too far? Did he go? They weren't asking, from what we saw, there was no indication of anything untoward. He wasn't asking him to change his opinion. Mm-hmm. Hank Brennan was trying to make a big deal out of the fact, like, oh, it would have been nice for us to know about the, you know, pedestrian strikes at night are more frequent. Well, number one, duh. Like, I mean, you know, like, I don't need to be an ARCA expert to know that it's harder to see people in the dark. But beyond that, like, aside from the snark of that, at trial, he testified to it. So, like, he's like, you did know. Read, like, Brennan needs to read the transcript. He knew, because on direct examination, he said those exact words, meaning that the Commonwealth had the ability to cross-examine him on that. But really, the reality is, that's kind of a helpful fact for the Commonwealth that they could have used, because he testified to it on direct examination. There was no hiding the ball. That was, like, literally, I used the clip on our YouTube channel. Allison went through to all the hearings that took place and to the trial and found the clip exactly where Wolf says exactly those words about pedestrian strikes at night are far more common because of, obviously, the, you know, the difficulty in visibility.
Sure.
So, like, to me, like, to be honest with you, I think this is going to be much ado about nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, but who knows? I mean, there's people that are of the mindset that she cannot stand Alan Jackson, that she wants him off that case. You know, I would just forewarn people that are, you know, anxious to get Alan Jackson off that case. If she does decide to pull his ticket and remove him, mm-hmm. it's going to absolutely trigger Karen Reed's Sixth Amendment right to counsel of her choice. He is a retained attorney. That's who she wants. He's definitely lead counsel. Mm-hmm. And I fully anticipate if she does try to remove him or does remove him, we will see exactly what happened in the Richard Allen case when Judge Gull removed Rosie and Baldwin. Mm-hmm. This thing's going to get taken up outside of her courtroom, either through interlocutory appeal or whatever the process is in Massachusetts as far as skipping the interlocutory appeal and going up to the Supreme Judicial Court to have them weigh in on it. So, and what that means ultimately, Tony, is this trial's getting delayed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a given on this at this point.
Right.
So at the end of the day, I mean, it all comes down to that one thing, that the one cheat that didn't have the dates on.
Right.
So we're going to have to rely on the dates that are given to be accurate, which I don't see any reason why they wouldn't be. And that would be probably confirmed through ARCA, correct? I mean, as far as, hey, here's...
100%. I mean, yeah. if you're Alan Jackson, you're saying, all right, I want every email with the header on
yeah.
it. And so the first day I sent it out to him, mm-hmm. I want the metadata from my Word document as to when I created it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just print the shit out.
Yeah.
Like the one thing I feel very, very confident in, again, and it's based on how much Alan Jackson has put into his legal career,
mm-hmm.
is that he wasn't doing shady shit.
No.
Yeah. I just like, it's like, I know people like to be angry at them because
sure.
they, you know, they came up with the conspiracy defense, you know, like number one, that's their job. Number two, the facts as they were situated, I think would have led any defense attorney down that path, you know, that there was something off about this. So like if you're getting an expert, it's finding this house long to die in the cold shit, the Google search. And that person is saying, okay, well, the Cellebrite extraction report showing me that thing was fucking Googled at 2:27 in the morning. I mean, Tony, if you're an attorney and you're a defense attorney, I mean, what are you thinking? You're like, what? Like,
yeah.
I mean, like this isn't like they were crafting this shit out of thin air.
No.
It's like they were looking at it. They had people coming to them saying that they were in that, you know, so they had information coming in that led them down that path, and they were willing to put it forth. And like anytime you're a defense attorney and you're going to go in all in on attacking the cops, and you're going to go beyond just this was an awful investigation in terms of how they processed the crime scene, but you're going to take that step further and you're going to say there's a cover up going on here. Believe me when I tell you this, defense lawyers are not doing that haphazardly because they know the resistance they're going to get from everybody on the government side. And that starts with the judge, and that then goes to the prosecuting attorney, and then it certainly goes to law enforcement. You are going to get major resistance and pushback on that because you're impugning the integrity of the government, mm-hmm. and they take that shit seriously. Judges take it very seriously. You can't just go in to a court of law as an officer of the court, which all lawyers are, and start pointing your fingers and calling cops liars, cheaters, and mm-hmm. cover-up artists without expecting the judge to say, you're making a serious accusation here, sir or madam. You yeah. better have the receipts to back it up, or you're looking at some serious shit down the road.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you have to know that they went in very carefully into that, having put together what they felt was very powerful evidence of what they believe is the theory of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got every right to do it. Not only do they have the right to do it, it would be ineffective assistance of counsel if they didn't do it.
Sure.
They couldn't ignore all that stuff and just say, oh, well, gee, you know, I mean, we can't say that it happened for certain because we weren't there. And all the witnesses are denying it happened, mm-hmm. but we can sure point it out and supply the facts that we have and let a trier of fact decide whether or not they think that might have been what happened. Because again, at the end of the day, Lally wasn't there. None of those cops were there, at least the ones that weren't in the house, but the ones investigating it. at the time that it happened, and neither were Alan Jackson or David Unetti. So, like, none of the lawyers and the cops were there when this thing went down. So all you're dealing with is theories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's going to play out. And I've been on record many, many a time in terms of, like, if you're trying to get an acquittal for Karen Reed, and you and I have talked about this ad nauseum, I am trimming a massive amount of the fat of the whole conspiracy thing out of that case. Mm-hmm. I'm putting the only things that I think that may be necessary to kind of put this thing together that, look, the injuries sustained by John O'Keefe quite simply are completely inconsistent with him being struck by a 6,000-pound vehicle. The fact that there's no bruising mm-hmm. at all anywhere on his body
yeah.
is in complete contravention to the fact that he was hit by a vehicle. It does not make any sense. I mean, it's always been my thing.
Yeah.
Like, me walking into that courtroom, if I were trying the case, my first statement, if I'm David Unetti, isn't like, Karen Reed was framed. It's like, that's a drop, you know, drop the mic type of statement to
yeah.
make as your first words out of your mouth to a jury. But what that does is that creates an expectation from the jury that you're going to be able to prove that up.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go in and say, John O'Keefe, simply put, was not struck by a motor vehicle, and the evidence is going to show that to you. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, that's a much easier road to get to reasonable doubt than it is where you've created a situation where you basically have burden shifted it to you as a defense, where you don't have a burden to prove up the story that you've just told the jury is what happened.
It would be, it'd be a much stronger defense just to go and take the story out of, they don't need to present a story, especially if there's not a whole lot of grounds for that story. If you can just focus specifically on, he was not struck by a vehicle, the evidence shows he was not. What happened to him? We don't know. But he wasn't struck by a vehicle. And because there are a lot of logical explanations as to what could have happened to him that don't involve the vehicle and also don't involve anyone in the house.
Right.
There's also a guy being drunk on a icy cold night and slipping and I mean, I could see 1,000 ways to die like that. And you're drunk.
So here, you know what my theory has always been. Like, I abandoned both of the state and the defense theory, and I took a lot of shit for it.
Sure.
And it wasn't so much the slip and fall aspect, mm-hmm. but imagine the situation where you're able to still get Wolf and Rensselaer on, and Wolf talks about the pneumatic cannon that he created, and the reason that he did it is he was firing the rocks glass out of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine a situation wherein you've got a highly intoxicated John O'Keefe, who's arguing with a highly intoxicated Karen Reed, who's driving the vehicle. She's pissed off that he's going into the fucking house. Like, why? Like, it's 1 a.m. The kids are home. Why the fuck are you going here, dude?
Yeah.
Like, they're going at it. They're bickering. She's like, get the fuck out of the car. He's like, fuck you. Gets out of the car. He's still got the glass. She's peeling away, and he whips the fucking glass exactly like what Wolf is saying that he's surmising might have happened.
Yeah.
And that's what shatters the fucking taillight. But while he's doing that on the incredibly slick road, the highly intoxicated John O'Keefe, because of the forward momentum of the throw, his feet slip out from underneath him and he smashes his head on the concrete, dude. I mean,
yeah,
that wound on his head, it looks exactly like what it would look like if both feet come out from underneath you. You're completely upended and you smash your head on the back of the concrete. That's what and say he's not knocked out completely. He gets up, he staggers into the yard, and that's where he falls.
Which is what happens quite often with people with head injuries. They don't just stay in the one spot unless they're out. They often get up, and they shouldn't, but they do. And then it's like, oh, and then everything
ends right there for him. So, I mean, that does, I mean, yeah, it makes sense. And then we go to the other issue, which is where then that this seems to be the, I think it's the catalyst of what brought in the idea that somehow the there are people in the house were connected is the idea of the dog bites. And I say idea of the dog bites because that's what it is. It's an idea. We don't truly know if it is dog bites or what it is. It looks like it might be. Some say it is, some say it isn't. But again, doesn't necessarily require one to go into one's house to get bitten by the dog on a cold night with a forest behind you and known coyote problems in the neighborhood.
Thank you.
And it doesn't, and honestly, it doesn't even have to be the coyotes. It could be anybody's dog that was let out to go to the bathroom in before the snowstorm started. Hey, go out. I mean, I let my dogs out all the time. I usually have a fenced yard, but if the gate's open and I don't know about it, sometimes they wander out. Some people don't have gates. They don't care. And so any animal that's out there sniffing around, a dog, and they see this body and it may have some blood on it, it's going to go check it out, especially if it's not moving and it's not a threat to it. It may kind of take a bite or two and then they get called back, come back in, you know, Snuckles, and then they're back in the house and nobody knows any different. I could see it being any one of those things. I could see it also being Chloe being let out to go to the bathroom and then coming back in and nobody being the wiser.
And exactly. And, you know, it's this thing where, again, if you're the defense, you don't have to prove it was a dog or a coyote. All you have to, if I'm the defense, say, okay, look, we're throwing this at you as a possibility of what may have happened. What you need to be asking yourselves, jurors, is in the state's theory of the case, what caused those injuries?
Yeah.
Because the only thing that and we're talking about wounds that are somehow under that are on the arm that somehow made their way through both his hoodie and whatever the undershirt, the long sleeve undershirt that he has. So two layers of clothing. Somehow you have these scratches. What in the state's theory, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, do you surmise could have caused those injuries? So, you know, because the only thing that I've ever heard, and I forget who it was or where I heard it, was that when Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe, that she like completely backed over him and it was something on the undercarriage of the vehicle that caused those scratches. I'm like, no.
It looks like so, road rash.
Put the onus where it belongs on the state. Like what in their theory creates those injuries? I don't know what caused it. Maybe it was a dog. Maybe it was a coyote. Maybe it was any kind of wild animal that was out there at the precipice of a snowstorm going out there trying to gather some food before the storm and they have to hole up. Yeah.
Or maybe it's not that at all. Maybe it's just him trying to get up and scraping his arm. And like, that's to me what it looks like.
I don't know. Like, yeah, dude, it's Yannetti and Jackson, I mean, they've got like some great, great attorneys over there, you know, and I'm not one to really, you know, second guess anybody's theory of defense or how they're going to try the case. I mean, from my perspective, I am simplifying the case massively and I'm putting the onus on the state because the strongest evidence in that case that the defense needs to realize and really highlight is that the injuries to John O'Keefe are inconsistent completely with him being struck by a vehicle of that size. The fact that there's no bruising, I would be hammering that point home because I don't give a shit if you've got whoever they're going to put on instead of Trooper Paul on to say that he was struck in the arm, the pirouette. Okay, if Tony, if you were struck, and I'm always trying to encourage you to go out and let your girlfriend hit you with your SUV just so we could do an actual test and then we'll come in and we'll put the results on. Dude, your entire arm, if you're hit at 30 miles an hour, 29 miles an hour, is going to be a big purple blob.
Yeah.
If you're struck in your torso, you are going to have a massive. The fact that there's no bruising anywhere on his body.
Yeah,
is to me the most telling thing. It is the reason that I don't think that she struck him with the vehicle, truthfully. And I think if you hammer that point home over and over and over again, when the jury goes back, they're going to be like, yeah, what about the no bruises thing now, man? Like make it make sense to me.
That's how you make, that's how you create reasonable doubt without going over the top with a fantastical story that makes people go, yeah, I don't think so.
Exactly. You know, because I mean, the defense, they're of the mindset, you know, the problem with a reasonable doubt verdict is that the people that think that Karen ran John over, like your friend Jennifer Coffin Denver, is like convinced that it happened. Like those people will never change their minds. Sure. So, you know, they've taken it upon themselves not to get a not guilty based on reasonable doubt, but to exonerate her in the eyes of everybody by trying to prove that this is what happened.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like, for me, and I think that they've been able to get Karen onto that side of it as well, where she's like, yeah, like a reasonable doubt verdict would be great, but I don't want that. I need people to know that I didn't do this, so that when I'm trying to live the rest of my life, half the people on the planet aren't thinking that I'm a murderer, you know?
And yeah, it's like, and it's a great goal to have, but that's not how people work. And even if you didn't do it, you're not going to change people's minds. I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, if she's out, it's time for a relocation, start fresh. And yep,
that's it.
Yeah, because unfortunately that's how people are going to be.
That's it, man.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.